She's to sick bay. The doctor should look at it as soon as possible.
It is the way in which we propagate our species. Please demonstrate how this is accomplished.
So, what's next?
I don't know.
Temba, his arms wide. Casual track. When they recapped Star Trek. Nerd and Ty, when the horrible, horrible endorsement is referenced. I am Charlie, his manuscript unfinished. Fan of Community, when Troy and Abed made for references to television.
Alan Moraine! Miles, his reference incorrect. His dysfunction executive. Blake Seven, his fandom mocked. Blake's boys, a dream crushed.
Miles and Charlie, on the Zencaster call. Battle of the Atom, when they rank three of a thing, but Star Trek, where space is scary, but people are mostly good. Worst idea of all time, when tangents are made, and overthinking it, when there is discourse. Charlie and Miles, on the Zencaster call. Dunning-Kruger, where knowledge is assumed, even when there is none. Right, I don't know if I even got all of those right, and I'm not keeping it up for more than this minute and a bit. So, I'm just going to move on from that and say, welcome to Casual Trek. We're going to be covering three episodes of Star Trek where language got a bit weird. So, before we go on, Miles, what non-Star Trek thing have you been enjoying since we last spoke?
Well, I have been re-listening to one of my favorite novels, which is Catch-22 by Joseph Heller.
Ooh.
It is a very fun and sad book. And it's a very strange kind of style of comedy, because it is all about contradictions, both bureaucratic and not.
Yeah. Yes, I read it when I was far too young to get most of it, and one day should go back.
Like, I think it's one of those books that I tried to first read it at like 20, and I did not get what the hell was going on at all. And then I got it as an audiobook, and having it be read to me, I could then kind of get like the pace of the pattern of what it's going for.
Nice. Do I have anyone fun doing the narration for it?
This one is read by Trevor White, so he does a good job.
Yeah.
But it's.
Cool.
And Charlie, what about you? What non-Star Trek thing have you been enjoying?
So, I've been once again back in the land of manga and of anime with Sakamoto Days, which is both on the Shonen Jump manga app and on Netflix, and it's just been a nice fun story. It's kind of what if John Wick but slightly less tragic and more functional, as Sakamoto is a hitman, or was, until he fell in love, promised his wife that he would never murder again, and opened a news agent's. And then, of course, people are sent after him to kill him because you don't quit. And it feels simultaneously very John Wick and very Kyle Starks as well. As again, it's also kind of like what if Shane Sexcastle, but functional, as in that comic, Sexcastle wants to just open a flower shop and isn't allowed to because a bunch of hitmen want to kill him.
Sorry. Sexcastle?
Yeah, Sexcastle.
This sounds like it should be a gag in a Warren Ellis comic.
No, it's something far better. It's a comic by Kyle Starks, who always seems to love writing about assassins and hitmen. And in this case, it is about Shane Sexcastle, who you first see being like a first person view of him being born, and the doctor being like, oh my god, look, this baby, he was born mean. And it just gets better from there.
I thought it was going to be that the baby was literally born with a gun.
I mean, I'm shocked that he wasn't. And yeah, at one point he even has gunchucks, which are nunchucks for their guns. Anyway, Sakamoto Days has an amount of that energy, as all the hitmen that are sent after Toru Sakamoto are just as stupid, just as ludicrous. They each have weird themes, and a lot of the time, he does a Superman. So many of them are either recruited to be staff at the newsagents, rounding out the core cast, with a psychic assassin and the daughter of, like, mafia boss. But a lot of the people that are sent to murder him, because he's not killing them, a lot of the time he'll just awaken an existential kind of thing of, like, shit, is this making me happy? No, I'm going to have to go away and think about this. Shit. And watching him kind of diffuse all of these hitmen non-lethally has been a real joy.
Okay, so Rihanna and I went to see a film yesterday, Love Hurts, which stars Ki-Hui Kwan, who from the Goonies at Short Round in Temple of Doom, and of course Everything Everywhere All at Once. And it does sound kind of like a very similar premise, that he was this like badass hitman who left the life and became a real estate agent, and then gets pulled back in. I admit, Love Hurts was fun, not great. But the one hitman who wants to be a poet and just writes these terrible, terrible poems, as well as being a hitman, was like the best character. Sean Austin, also from the Goonies, turns up in two scenes and effortlessly steals the show.
Of course, I still remember the old TV show Jeremiah, where it was fine. But when Sean Austin arrives, it's like, yes, yes, this is what the show needed.
Yeah.
Like, this guy's effortlessly just so good.
It's like in Stranger Things, when he turns up in season two, being the boyfriend, and he's like the nicest guy, and he's like the nicest guy ever who gets a really tragic end trying to save the kids.
I was so upset with that.
Those damn kids.
Damn those children. Damn all the children.
So I might have to check out Sakamoto Days now.
Yes. I think Matt Mercer is doing one of the voices in it, but I can never recognize, because I've seen one Critical Role episode where he butchered the rules of Monster Hearts and then never went back to it. But I gather he's a good voice actor, and there is some fun voice acting in there.
Okay. Well, so I might have to definitely check that out. Okay. But we are not here to chart Charlie's slow, slow descent into perpetual weebdom. We're actually a Star Trek podcast.
Wow. It's... man, I know it's true, but you really didn't have to put it like that.
Look, Charlie, at least I didn't say, once again, say you're wrong inside.
Yeah, yeah, which, again... yeah, I'll have to stop making fun of the weeb shop that's at the open market.
I mean, you'll have to. I mean, like some of your best guest stars and co-hosts are weeb or weeb adjacent.
True, true. Oh my god.
Oh, before we actually get started, I do actually want to quickly plug something.
Go on.
I appeared on a live stream with perpetually bullied Sean as he played through the fantastic game Out of This World, also known in Europe as Another World.
The
French side scroller game from Interplay, and a lot of fun was had. We will have a link in the show notes to the YouTube feed, and there is a good amount of Sean being ribbed for his many perpetual deaths in a game where you die and you die and you die.
Anyway, our first episode of Star Trek Tonight will be Star Trek Deep Space Nine, Season 1, Episode 3, titled Babel. This aired on the 24th of January 1993, with a teleplay by Michael McGreevy and Naren Shankar, the story by Sally Graves and Ira Stephen Bear, directed by Paul Lynch. The UK and US number one hit was The Same Thing, which was Whitney Houston with I Will Always Love You. Now, I'm not a massive Whitney Houston fan, but there is something very iconic about this one.
Yeah, I admit, I only noticed song because it, there was this very short-lived BBC sitcom done by the creator of Only Fools and Horses, John Sullivan, which was about a taxi cab company. And two of the characters, their song is only ever referred to as the song from The Bodyguard.
Yeah, I mean, that is basically how I knew this as. So yes, right, Miles, I believe you're the one recapping Babel.
Yep.
So, you've got 5 minutes. Don't try and set off any booby traps or anything. And go.
Chief Miles Edward O'Brien is having a day. Fix this, Chief. Fix that, Chief. My coffee's too hot, Chief. My gazpacho soup's too warm, Chief. Can you move the entire station 2 feet slightly to the left, Chief? He fixes a replicator, but unwittingly sets off a strange device buried deep in the replicator's systems. Business is bad at Quark's, and Odo is loving it! But when a customer gets angry at the poorly replicated food, Odo is forced to step in. Quark hacks into the station systems to find the location of working replicators on the command deck. O'Brien is run ragged by all the repairs and starts speaking gibberish. Getting flustered, he gets checked out by Bashir. Even worse, is actually also affecting his ability to write. Bashir believes it's a form of aphasia, but there's no sign of it in the readings. Business is booming at Quark's, and Odo is hating it! Quark claims that Rom fixed the replicators. Sisko gets Kira to investigate O'Brien's work, and Dax starts coming down with the same problem. Bashir discovers that this is actually a virus that's causing aphasia, but more people are suffering. The station is under quarantine, but one of the alien ships wants to leave instead of catching the disease. Quark is sneaking into the command deck to use their replicators to replicate food for his establishment without their permission, but Odo was actually disguised as his trolley the whole time. That's cart for you transatlantic colonial listeners. You see, Rom is still an idiot at this point in the show, and Odo was suspicious immediately. Bashir tracks down the cause of the virus. It's in the command-level replicators. The virus is adapting, hence the differing levels of contamination. But it doesn't matter. Enough people are now contaminated that the virus is now airborne. The entire station is at risk of infection. Kira finds the device. It's a Cardassian piece of equipment that programmed the virus into the food at a microscopic level. But Sisko has more personal concerns. Bashir has the whole, you better get down here, something terrible has happened, but I'm not going to tell you over the phone thing, which works as like a device in like a film or a TV show, but is so antithetical and would piss you off if done in real life. Jake is also infected. What a shock! Unused quarters are now being converted into a hospital. Quark is uninfected, and he's tried to get money from some of the patients who owe him cash. Oh, Quark, will your hyper-capitalistic ways ever change? Bashir discovers the cause of the virus. It's actually not the Cardassians. It's actually an old Bajoran device. It was smuggled aboard during construction of DS9 and never got triggered because the people who built it, you know, either got caught or killed 18 years ago. Kira is on the case, trying to track down who might have created the virus. But O'Brien, the first to be infected, is now running a fever. The virus is now directly attacking his nervous system. He'll be dead in 12 hours. Does this mean that this is the first ever episode in DS9 of Miles O'Brien has the worst fucking day? Kira finds the creator of the virus, but Deacon Ellig died 9 years ago, but he had an assistant with Cermak Wren. It's not much, but it's a lead. Odo and Quark are alone in the bar. Odo warns Quark not to steal anything since all the security forces are infected, and with it just being him, Kira, and Sisko, he has to go up and help. Boy, I sure hope Bashir doesn't come down with the he's infected. Kira finds Cermak Wren as a hospital administrator, but he denies knowing anything in the most suspicious way possible. Leaving Sisko and Odo in a runabout, Kira takes the runabout. Kira just doesn't ditch Sisko and Odo in a runabout. and goes to collect him. Despite Sisko saying, hey, you can't go to Bajor, you'll spread the infection. And Kira's like, I swear, I am not going to step foot on Bajor. Jaleo, the alien who wanted to leave earlier, is now trying to leave the station, despite his ship is still attached to the mooring ring. But he's powering up his engines. Sisko plans to let him escape, but the stress in the mooring clamps has now trapped the ship to the station, with an unstable ship engine threatening to blow. In orbit of Bajor, Kira contacts Cermak, and then beams him on board the runabout, exposing him to the virus, and shoots him back to Deep Space Nine. As Sisko and Odo try to stabilize the ship, Odo suggests blowing the mooring clamps, but now Sisko has flattened him down with the virus!
We are at 5 minutes. So, let's start the stopwatch. Can you cure this now?
Miniskirt aubergine. Eggplant. Thunderbirds a go. Aardvark.
No.
Aardvark. Aardvark.
Oh, no, this is infected.
No, wait, sorry. I just really like aardvarks.
Oh, okay, carry on.
As Sisko and Odo try to stabilize the ship, Odo suggests blowing the mooring clamps and shooting the ship out and letting it explode safely out of range. But now Sisko has come down with the virus, and now it's up to Odo and Quark, his good buddy Quark, to have to save the station. Cermak Wren doesn't know of a cure, but Kira has basically infected him, so he better start coming up with an answer fast. Quark beams Odo onto the ship, so that Odo can blow the ship out into space before it explodes. Odo and Quark do this. Cermak Wren is able to come up with an antidote, and things slowly return to normal. A vote of coffee. Sisko's coffee is still too hot. Whackety, schmackety, do.
Wow, that is 54 seconds over. And, God. All of that for a coffee, which I admit that'd be worth it. Like, you know, sometimes you just really need a coffee.
I feel this is one of the few times that Deep Space Nine needs that everyone stands around and laughs kind of scene that we get all the time at the end of the original series.
Oh, what? Like freeze frame, just so everyone's like, ha ha ha.
Like, you know, Sisko's like, Chief!
Miles.
O'Brien mugs the camera, and, like, Dax is laughing, Kira's laughing awkwardly because it's Kira, you know, and then freeze frame.
Yeah, I love how this is episode 3, and already the Odo-Quark dynamic is just, like, the two of them are so good at playing it.
Oh, yeah.
Odo's whole moment, leave him alone, only I bully Quark. Good.
We're still in that weird, kind of very gaunt Odo face, which I think he gets for like a good chunk of series one, and it's just off-putting, because I'm used to his more kind of, from series two onwards, or like maybe even later on in series one, he has a much more rounded face.
Yeah, there's more smoothness to that. I was watching this on a tablet while my partner was playing Ghost of Tsushima, so I was watching it and just looking at Odo's face going, is it the tablet? Like, is it seeing it at this scale, like this close, that is making me examine the makeup? But yeah, I'm pleased that it's not just me with that. Also, partway through this, I did just write insert pandemic jokes.
Oh, God, so much of this. So much of this has aged poorly.
Well, like, the amount of people trying to just carry on, even with a virus all over the station, and of course, the super spreader event of Quark's Bar as well, going, yeah, we're going to open up and party, even though everyone should be in quarantine. So, yeah, and you've made it airborne, you fuck. Also, yeah, seeing Quark in ops is weird. I know it will occasionally happen, but just in general, this early on, going, oh my God.
Usually Quark is only up there for, like, complaining purposes, for, like, whatever comedy subplot Quark is in this week. And I definitely feel that we're still in that the much more unscrupulously shifty Quark, which, again, also gets kind of toned down to his more, yeah, he's a bad guy, but, you know, he's a nice bad guy.
Yeah, yeah. And in a way, you can almost, like, write off the Rom side of it, of Odo going, well, the obvious tell is that Rom's an idiot. It's like, yeah, you two would believe that, no matter how actually competent Rom turns out to be. Because, yeah, Quark believes that he's an idiot. Odo believes everyone that's not him is an idiot. So, yeah.
This was originally meant to be a TNG episode.
Yes.
I'll be honest, I don't think it would have been as fun.
No. Like, it makes sense with Odo's weird genetics that he'd be fine for longer than most. And Quark being immune, it's like, fine, give the least competent person immunity to it. That just makes it more funny. And I assume Data would be the main person that wouldn't be affected.
Probably.
He would not be as fun as Quark was with this.
No. And then, or Odo, even. And then I would say, like, then there's also how Kira gets a scientist, which definitely, like, you can't see any of this, of, like, the next generation characters doing that. But I just love Kira's just like, yeah, I'm not going to set foot on the planet. I'm just going to kidnap him.
Yeah. It's such a Kira move. That kind of, yeah, fuck it. I'm going to abduct a guy. I'm going to infect him with this virus just to make absolutely sure that now he really has to fix it.
Yeah.
That was brilliant.
That's one of those few times where I'd say, like, a character in a Star Trek pulls what is definitely a Blake 7 move.
I did like that there was that willingness to go, yeah, actually, almost all of the main cast are infected. And it is our guy of the week with Cermak Wren having to fix it. Because, yeah, it's not always going to be our leads that can sort this out. Oh, speaking of which, while a lot of Memory Alpha was not useful with, like, oh, this is named after Tower of Babel. So, thanks. Thanks wow. for the wow. obvious reference, guys. What are you, the IMDb trivia page?
No. It's clearly named after the R.F. Kuang novel, Babel, which came out 2 years ago.
Of course. The fun thing here was apparently a couple of Ren and Stimpy references with Cermak Wren, and also with references to Gull Spumco.
Which, God.
So, guys, that's, like, I know there wasn't an appearance of Gull Spumco, but I loved that existed.
You would want Gull Spumco to be played by Billy West.
Yes, definitely. But yeah, this was for an early DS9 episode, and I don't write off early DS9 to the level I write off early TNG.
No.
I just figure it's mostly all right, but they're still figuring it out. This was really nice, really solid. I remember when we were talking about Move Along Home, how a lot of the actors were in that kind of uncertain, you know, that Picard encounter at Farpoint, like, what have I done kind of point. But they've already done this, which is so much better and so much more them.
I did like how Chief O'Brien is just, like, put upon in the entire, like, opening 5 minutes of the story.
Oh, God.
Like, he is having to fix everything.
Like, we know that's his day generally, but yeah, it felt especially so, like, doubly so.
It feels like in these early days, when they're still trying to get the station up and running, it is far more aggressively, Chief O'Brien is the last guy fixing everything right now.
Speaking of which, I do like that it wasn't a Cardassian trap.
Oh, so did I.
As well, that was a nice touch. I kind of, seeing it, because I know we got, I think, a season and a half for a rewatch during lockdown before we started this with Emma and I must have seen this. So when I first heard, oh yes, trap, all that, I kind of clicked, but just, you know, viewing it and going, yeah, like, they assume it's Cardassian at first.
Yeah.
Because those guys are jerks. And it definitely gives a lot of, you know, one of the things I do like about it was nice that it's also things like this where it would have been an act of resistance if the Cardassian rule had carried on.
And that there are so many different elements and different resistance groups from the Bajorans. It's not just one unified rebellion. It is a whole bunch of small cells.
Yeah, that kind of thing. You would have made sure that not every cell knows what every cell's doing. Who knows who's going to get nicked?
Or just simply, you know, some people might be like more aggressive, less aggressive. It's like in Andor and Rogue One, where you have like the rebellion, and then you have like Saw Gerrera, who are the more aggressive, like partisans. And you have like the disagreement between the two sides over how far should we be pushing it?
Yeah. So with Babel, we have a nice big old list of Star Trek episodes from best to worst, going all the way. In fact, I've realized we have a movie at the start and at the end of this list now.
Oh yeah.
Which feels like nice bookends.
Does Section 31 really count as a movie?
Technically, yes.
Fine.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah, spoilers for a few seconds from now is our number one space here is taken up with Star Trek II, Wrath of Khan. Then down at number 50, we have Meld from Voyager, featuring your friend and mine, Lizard Man, Brad Dourif. Then we have in 100, we have Yesteryear, where Spock accidentally gets erased from time in the animated series. And at the bottom, at 151, we have Star Trek Section 31, where they do What If Borderlands the Movie, but a Star Trek. So where on this list should Babel sit?
All right, I'm having a look. I see that you're kind of... Let's see. I wouldn't say that this is one of the greats.
No, it's good.
It's good. Let's see. Okay. At 38, we have Crossover, where we get our first return to the Mirror Universe and Odo fucking explodes. Oh,
that's so good.
I don't think that this is as good. So no. I'm gonna go down a bit more. Let's see. Okay.
Ooh, in 52, we have The Assignment, which has Keiko possessed by a Power Wraith, and yet another bad day for O'Brien.
All right, let's see. Above that, we've got number 51, Strange New Worlds Among the Lotus Eaters.
I think this is probably better than that.
Yeah.
As much as a lot of the aphasic virus seems to be just quietly looking confused after saying a bit of gibberish, which... it sounds like the writers had problems with the gibberish.
I did like the moment when Bashir gets contaminated and he starts looking at the screen and all the words are also gibberish, because apparently aphasia can also affect how you perceive language as well as just how you communicate.
That was a very nice touch. I was surprised, you know, Star Trek being Star Trek, they would spend the extra money on getting a kind of a weird view screen layout. But yeah. So yeah, I think this is possibly above Among the Lotus Eaters. So you're hovering on spot number 50 now with Voyager's Meld, where I think Meld might be a little better, but that might just be loving Brad Dourif.
Meld is better. I mean, like, you get a good... Like, it's always nice when one of the actors who's playing the Vulcans gets to kind of, like, do more.
Mm.
Because it's generally, like, I would say it looks like being a Vulcan is sometimes the most, like, thankless job of an actor in Star Trek, because you have to stand there and just look mildly pissed off at everything.
Oh, and Tim Russ is definitely capable of doing that.
And, of course, our favourite moisty man, Brad Dourif.
Yeah. Okay. So... What, putting this at the new number 51 then?
Yeah.
one day I will actually be able to do a Brad Dourif voice, because there are too many NPCs in role-playing games where I would love to be able to speak like him.
Or him or Combs.
Yeah, yeah, Combs is another good one. I've been trying to do a Matt Berry at the moment when I've been Randolph Carter in the Arkham Horror card game, and it is bad. Like, it is not good, unfortunately. But sometimes when you get the right extension of syllables, you know, when it's the city of Ulthar.
It's always going to be, for me, it's always going to be like the very deep voice he puts on for Garth Marenghi's Dark Place.
Oh, God, yeah.
You and he were buddies, weren't you? When I first met you, I was strictly solo. I never thought you could make solo have like five syllables.
He's so good at it. Oh, I'm so jealous.
But if you and he want to be buddies again, well, I won't stand in your way.
Oh. Yes, yeah, so that's our first episode ranked for the evening. And next, we're going into the present day. Yes, the one you all know that we're here for. We're saving that for dessert for the end of this. So we are fast forwarding to the 12th of May, 2022, for Star Trek Strange New Worlds Season 1, Episode 2, titled Children of the Comet. This was written by Henry Alonzo Myers and Sarah Tarkov.
Oh, wait, so it's not based on a short story by Stephen King?
No, that's Korn.
Oh.
Children of Korn. Which, as a King fan, despite his many, 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 many flaws, I have not seen a single Children of the Korn movie yet.
I have seen it on humorous YouTube review videos, and I've heard it talked about in podcasts.
Yes, in Just King Things, I've just reached Storm of the Century, so I watched that. And it is very notably not on the what non-Star Trek things I've been enjoying this week. Anyway, back to this. It was written by Henry Alonzo Myers and Sarah Tarkov, and directed by Maya Villavillo. I'm pretty sure that's how it's pronounced. I know I've looked it up before, so she has directed previous episodes. Anyway, the UK and US number one hit is the same thing once again. This was an easy one to watch the music videos for, because yeah, there were so many that where the streams were crossed. And in this case, it was Harry Styles with As It Was, which is all right.
I enjoyed, like, I think, didn't we do this one when we did Strange New Worlds way back when, the pilot for this season? Mm. And yeah, it's a catchy song. I enjoyed it, you know.
Yeah, I think this is like our third or fourth time, which for the modern shows, they don't tend to last as long.
No.
For big hits. But yeah, it's all right. I mean, I say that, we'll get the same two for every episode of Star Trek Prodigy Season 2 because they all came out at once. So, yeah. So, yes, I am ready. I am a child of the comet.
Okay, Charlie, are you ready to accept the comet into your life?
I am. I am very ready to accept the comet.
Charlie, do you accept that the comet loves you?
You know what? I do.
Okay, Charlie, are you prepared to lick the comet?
I mean, at the moment, I am drinking reduced-price Vimto Energy, so that shows I have no good taste. So,
Charlie, if you love the comet, and the comet loves you, you will lick the comet and rub yourself against the comet.
I'm eyeing up my microphone. I'm not licking the microphone for a bit.
Fair enough. Okay, how about this? Could you try and recap the episode in about 5 minutes or less?
I could give it a go.
All right, fantastic. Okay, we prepare for your inevitable failure.
Hooray!
And engage.
So, it's a desert planet. Oh, God! Oh, God, we're back in Section 31! Oh, no! Oh, God! Wait, hang on. It's a normal desert planet. It's all right. Emergency over. The locals here are a bit dusty and watching a comet. You know who else is watching a comet? It's the USS Enterprise. And on the ship, Uhura's got her first dinner with the higher-ups at Pike's swanky pad. Ortegas hazes her by saying it's formal wear only. And then Uhura makes things worse, trying to help Hema cook, not realizing he's got some daredevil senses going on. It's all going a bit poorly. Pike gives an anecdote at his own expense, which confuses Spock, who's told sometimes things are bad enough, all you can do is laugh. Put a pin in that. Uhura is idly humming a Kenyan tune and mentions how many languages she can speak, 37 for the record. She's on rotation as a cadet, going through different duty stations. And where does she want to end up? She doesn't actually know. In fact, she doesn't know if she wants to be in Starfleet at all, which doesn't go down well with anyone here. Thousands of people apply for Starfleet, and she's just there because she didn't want to remain in Nairobi, where her family died. That is heartbreaking, and Pike wishes her luck, you know, wherever she ends up. And Spock says, "Ooh, you fucked up," but, you know, in a Vulcan way. And maybe if she doesn't want to be here, she should shift over so someone else who really wants to can try. Anyway, the comet. That's the problem here. Who put a force field around a comet? They're trying to stop it from obliterating a planet, Daleb, which is pre-warp, our deserty place. And yeah, trying to shoot it out of the way isn't working. There is some kind of structure inside, and they'll have to go there on foot to get through the shield. So Uhura, Spock, La'an, and Sam Kirk are all going to check it out. There's a weird Lovecraftian temple and a cave inside with an egg, a really big egg. Sam tries touching the patterns on the egg and is shocked almost to death. He needs to get out, but force fields are back up and no one's beaming out. The egg glows, and Uhura's like, "What the fuck?" Spock mentions for, you know, Yahira's a xenolinguistics expert. You figure it out. The Enterprise plans to burn through the shields by modulating frequencies, only to get shot by a much, 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 much bigger ship. The owners of the ship are shepherds. They escort the comet, Mahanit, and they don't want anyone interfering with it. Pike mentions that the comet's going to be obliterated when it smashes into the planet anyway, killing everyone there. And the shepherd's like, yeah, maybe. Have faith. Mahanit is an ancient arbiter of life. And whatever happens, that's fated to be. Uhura scans the egg while humming, and Spock delivers a frankly mediocre pep talk, launching Uhura into an existential crisis. His second attempt is a little better, and she hums again, causing the cave to light up. It's responding to the music. Uhura gets La'an and Spock to sing along with her, and the egg opens. Now they need to convince it to lower the shields. Well, they just kind of try again with the humming, and it works, and they beam out. The shepherds really don't like this, and they open fire. The comet is still falling, and the shepherds are barely taking any damage. Spock suggests maybe the comet can move itself. Wink. Pike flatters Ortegas to get her to fly ahead of a comet, and they power down and phone the shepherds, going, "All right, guys, sorry, we've had a breakdown here, and we're a bit injured. We're unable to get out of the way. If we stay here, we'll be disrupting the comet. Could you tow us away?" And they do. While this is happening, Spock sneaks off in a shuttle, flies around, helping the shuttle to the comet to change course by carving a bit of ice off of it. Spock laughs on the comms, confusing everyone, but he does note, apparently, sometimes things go so badly, all you can do is laugh. Ha ha.
Ha ha.
Ha ha. Yes. Okay, that's not a time's up, ha ha.
No, that's in 17 seconds.
Oh, brilliant. Okay. Yeah, planet safe. Water vapor from the comet has changed the world, creating rain. Mahanit genuinely has given life. Uhura confirms she even translated the comet song, and it predicted this, including that Spock would cut the bit. Oh, the false confidence there. But I could get to the end before 5 minutes were up. I was vamping around the laughter because I figured I was exactly at the 5 minute threshold there. And if I hadn't have done that, I probably could have got this.
Okay. All right. So I'm going to start the stopwatch, and I'm going to shave off 10 seconds.
Ah.
And go.
Anyway, yeah, so the shepherds phone up to have a bit of a gloat, and like, sure, whatever, guys. They're like, yeah, you got us. Spock revisits his chat with Uhura and says, actually, Starfleet would be fortunate if you stuck around, I guess. And there's also a plot with Pike stressing about his fate of getting all melty, saving some cadets, but that'll be dealt with later, so we're not covering it here. The end.
30 seconds, but we'll take the 10 seconds off, so 20 seconds.
Okay, so that was all right. I love the glowy cave.
Yeah.
You know, this is the second episode of Strange New Worlds, and yeah, I was so ready for this after already having seen the pilot a couple of times when that aired. And this was the first thing they did where you got a problem and you Starfleet the hell out of it. Although I have one slight objection or one slight issue.
It is the fact that no one ever goes back to check on Sam after he's nearly dead.
No, I mean, that's fine. He's going to die at some point.
They're going to just drag him, just pop him in the corner and go, he'll be fine.
I did wonder if he was going to be Kenny, if he was going to almost die. Yeah, I was going to wonder if he was going to be the Kenny and almost die every single episode until it actually takes. But, you know, as of the end of season 2, I think it's still with us. With this one, watching it this time, which I think, God, probably makes the third time. So I watched it myself. I watched it with Emma for the first season, and then
watching it now. Yeah, same here.
And yeah, it feels a little against Gene Roddenberry's attitude of the Enterprise meets God and fucks it up or kills it with a rock. And in this case, maybe they should have had faith in the comet. You know, that felt a bit weird, kind of holy destiny almost.
I don't know, because, like, you know, I'm assuming, like, my assumption is that it's, like, advanced technology.
Yeah.
It was able to, like, predict that the crew would be there and do what it did.
Maybe it foundationed or something.
Yeah.
Like, holy maths!
You know, it's like, oh, these guys are going to come in and try and fuck it up. So we're just going to alter, make sure that everything goes according to, we want to make sure that everything's coming up Milhouse.
Yeah. I also liked that the Prime Directive wasn't fucked with, but they did need to kind of navigate General Order 1 a little bit and go, look, we're not interfering with them. The comet would kill them. That's probably bad, and we are here, so let's just nudge it and not be noticed. So yeah, that was quite good. And but we saw the alien species, and then, you know, no one from Starfleet actually had to interact directly with them.
I enjoyed this episode. Like, it's a good unit of Trek.
Yes.
Kind of definitely got my hopes up on Strange New Worlds that it was going to be, I really hate to say traditional show, but it was like more going back to start, you know, to kind of like the more typical episode of the week nature of Star Trek.
Yeah, I think it is that thing of showing us that it is a thing of the week, that problems aren't just shootable.
It's a procedural.
Yeah, exactly. That, I think, is the main thing of what we kind of end up missing. Slightly, and I think it's why my general attitude towards a lot of the modern Trek is give us, like, lower budget and special effects episodes a little more, you know? Give us the occasional bottle episode, or, oh, look, they're in a cave.
Yeah, like, not everything needs to be end of the universe type stuff. It doesn't always have to be life or death of the Federation. Sometimes it just gets to be like that, you know, day of the week. Pike, I love the Pike. I love this job.
Yeah.
Oh man. Oh, Hema. You are one of my favorites. Like, from the moment you turn up here, you are my grumpy, snarky, sarcastic albino with a heart of gold.
yeah, where there was once an Odo, now there's a Hemmer.
There's a Hemmer. He is like my out of the new characters introduced, he is my favorite. While I liked his death, I do find it a shame because I really wanted to see more of the character, and I wanted to see more of him and Spock, because there is very much like they seem to get up whenever we see them together. They seem to kind of like have a friendship.
Yeah. Yeah, it's quite nice when you get that sort of thing. And we sadly didn't see much of him. I don't know if the Apocrypha, if like the extended kind of like novels or whatever have more of those relationships. But yeah, hopefully that's something that can get explored in other media now that is, you know, carked it.
And I like the scenes with Spock and Uhura.
Yeah. Spock and Uhura were good fun. The flirting from Nurse Chapel and Spock's obliviousness to it all was entertaining when Uhura was calling him on it. And yeah, his just complete confusion of the whole situation.
Although this is, again, one of those problems where it all just kind of makes like the relationships in the original show just kind of weird, because you have like that moment in Charlie X when Uhura is very clearly teasing Spock when he's just kind of sitting there playing his Vulcan harp thing and just singing along. But I do like when we get to see the younger, a bit more brasher Spock and his relationship with Uhura this early on.
Yeah, well, and I don't know. Maybe, again, it's that thing of trying to no-prize it sometimes. And
yeah.
Just going, well, they're used to each other and she will take the piss out of him. And hopefully, even if he doesn't always get it, he's aware that this is done with love.
Yeah.
Rather than something for the non-existent Starfleet HR to deal with. Once they're done with all of Bones's many, many complaints.
Unfortunately, you know, McCoy is probably HR on the Enterprise.
Oh, no.
It's like, I like also, no, like, small thing with Spock. When he's definitely extolling, like, when he's telling, kind of like taking Uhura to task for taking Starfleet lightly.
Yeah.
Like, treating this as a gap year. And that you do see, like, you know, how much Spock, even though he's all very much logical, believe, you know, he does subscribe to the values and the cause. Like, there is a loyalty to the idea.
Like, everyone's taken a bit of polite, quiet offense to how blasé Uhura was about that. And yeah, Spock actually wording it in a way where it's like, he's not emotional because he's Spock, but this is how he expresses his offense.
See, when Spock is telling you, you done fucked up, you done fucked up.
Oh yeah. Oh my god. Yeah, so, yeah, where on the big list?
Oh, and Last mention. I loved when La'an mentioned she can't sing at all, because apart from Celia Gooding, who plays Uhura, Christina Chong is the one who is a musician in her main career.
Yes, I've not heard actually either of their solo endeavors, but of course they were both very good fun in Subspace Rhapsody.
Yeah.
Which is currently in spot number 26 on the big list.
Ooh.
And probably better than this, even though this is more of a unit of Star Trek.
This is more of a unit of Trek. Like, I know you said that you would, if you wanted to show someone to kind of explain what Star Trek is, you would do Strange New Worlds. I would probably do this episode. Because again, it's a procedural. It's like this is our Tuesday.
Mm.
Here's the characters. You know, the characters are presented with a situation. We have the complications, and then we have the characters stepping up. Like, we have Uhura, like, getting rid of her self doubt to realize I can make a difference. I get it.
Yes. Yeah, that she actually rises up to that is great. And yeah, as you say, it is a very good unit of Star Trek. Okay, so let's see. If we're saying better than, well, lower than Subspace Rhapsody, but still good.
Yeah.
That's 27 or lower. 27 itself is the original series's Amok Time, with the iconic Spock fighting the horniness out of his system.
Oh, man. Amok Time is iconic.
Yeah. Okay, slightly less iconic. Just below that, we have Discovery's The Hope That Is You, Part 1, where Michael is trapped in a grim, dark future where things are a bit more kind of generic sci-fi-ish and needs to bring some of that Starfleet magic back.
Do you want an episode I do think this is definitely better than?
Mm.
Episode 30, Deep Space Nine's Rejoined.
Yes.
An episode I still haven't seen, so there... in about 20 years, so therefore this episode is better than one I haven't seen.
I mean, it's a good episode, I'll give it that, but yeah, thanks for that reminder, Mars.
Look, I make fun of you enough on the show as is. I should be completely willing to make fun of my own foibles.
Fair. Okay. Yeah.
Although I do think that we should do a bonus episode where I finally watch this and see if it changes up, you know, if it changes, you know, it stays on its current spot in the big list.
Yeah, I'd be down for that. But before then, we need to find a home for the children of the comet.
Okay. Is this better than number 29's Forget Me Not?
Oh God! With the slug caves.
When Michael Burnham and Gray, is it?
No,
Adira.
Yes, Adira Tau. When they get kind of the past memories of the other symbiote, the kind of symbiotic history and all that. I think this is better than that. Forget Me Not is a good episode, but I feel that this is probably better along those lines. Similarly, The Hope That Is You, I kind of feel this is probably better than that, as that's kind of, it's good. It's quite action-y Star Trek more than it is Star Trek-y Star Trek. Yeah, it's good, but I feel, let's see, Forget Me Not's all right, and The Hope That Is You Part 1 is good fun, but I feel it could probably go above both of those, as The Hope That Is You is a bit kind of an action-y season premiere more than it is a Star Trek-y one.
Yeah, I can agree. I will agree with that.
Cool. So that is a new number 28. Yeah, our third episode of the night is the main event, the one you've all been waiting for. It is Star Trek The Next Generation Season 5, Episode 2, titled Darmok. This aired on the 30th of September 1991. Teleplay by Joe Minoski, story by Philip Lazebnik and Joe Minoski, and directed by Winrich Colby. The UK number one hit was Bryan Adams with Everything I Do It For You. And moving from Bryan Adams to Bryan Abrams in the US with Color Me Bad's I Adore Me More, which seemed to go on forever.
It was fine. I am not going to deny that at the moment, Everything I Do For You, I did start kind of just rocking out.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, like Bryan Adams is cheesy as hell, but there is, again, like Whitney Houston, there is something kind of appealing about that cheesy retro.
It's the quintessential 80s power ballad, a musical form I want to come back.
Yeah, and I was trying to have a look to see if there was anything interesting in the history of Color Me Bad, aside from them doing, they were very much your one-hit wonder type, mainly with I Wanna Sex You Up. And they did fall apart to equal combinations, drinking problems and religion.
Always a good combination, I think.
Yeah, the classic, really. But yes, what is also classic is the episode that's about to be recapped by you, Miles. So, Charlie, his hand on the timer. Miles, his recap begun.
The Enterprise is heading to make first contact with a race called the Temerians. There have been previous encounters, but each time, the children of Tamar have been seen as incomprehensible. Picard believes that with patience that they communicate... No. They're bloody incomprehensible, mate. Stating names of individuals and locations. The alien captain, who is called Daphon in the script, argues with a second, pulling out two knives, yelling, "Darmok and Jalard at Tanagra!" And both he and Captain Picard are teleported down to the surface of a nearby planet, the Temerian ship blocking any attempt to beam back. Daphon repeats the statement, throwing a knife at Picard, saying, "Shaka," when the walls fell, when Picard refuses the knife, believing it to be a challenge of combat, and walks away in a huff. Riker tries to contact the Temerian ship, and it's not working. Riker orders Worf to get a team together and a shuttle, and go down to the planet to retrieve Picard, hoping that the Temerians won't escalate. Picard was clearly never a French Boy Scout, because he is failing to build a fire. Well, Daphon has got, like, a nice little fire pit going, he's doing some fire dancing, he's working on some s'mores, and Picard keeps trying to communicate, but fails each time. In the darkness, he watches Daphon perform a ritual, where he puts his fingers to his head, put a pin in that, and Daphon throws Picard a burning log of fire. Timber, his arms wide. Picard realizes that Temba is a person, his arms wide, a sign of giving. Daphon smiles happily as Picard understands what he's trying to put across. Worf has put together a team of one person and a shuttle, and he's heading down, but the Temerian ship fires on the shuttle, damaging it only enough to turn it back, not to actually hurt anyone. Geordi has a way to punch up the teleport beam, but it's going to take a day. Worf suggests just attacking the alien ship, but Riker won't risk a war, and orders Data and Troy to try and understand the alien language and make contact. Why there are no, like, xenolinguistic specialists on the flagship of the Federation is never covered. I'm assuming they're on break.
That's literally on my notes.
The next morning, Picard wakes up to find Daphon gone. Exploring a nearby area, he finds Daphon's journal and starts reading it. Watching footage of the communication, Data and Troy realize that with all their advanced technology and meeting hundreds of thousands of different aliens, they simply can't say hello. But they do get a clue. Both Darmok and Tanagra appear in the history of the planet Chantel 3. We may have got a working hypothesis going on. Enter Daphon, pursued by an invisible alien creature. Picard takes the offered knife. Riker tells the Forge to beam Picard out, even though he doesn't have enough time. The creature stalks Picard and Daphon. Daphon exclaiming, "Shaka," when the walls fell, when Picard tries to escape, and then Picard realizes something. The Temerians, they communicate by example, by metaphor. The two are able to finally join forces, but both are knocked to their feet. The creature attacks Daphon, and that's when Picard is beamed away. It doesn't work, the field is too strong, and Picard is teleported back to a mortally wounded Daphon. The Temerians have strengthened the field. Worf is now still advocating, "Let's just attack the ship and then beam Picard back before the creature can kill him." Data and Troy have worked out what Picard already has. The Temerians are a very abstract metaphorical species. They talk in metaphor, but since you don't know the context of the words and the imagery, they still can't communicate. They use Romeo and Juliet as an example by stating Juliet at her balcony. But since you don't know the context of Shakespeare, you're shit out of luck. Picard makes Daphon comfortable and starts to work out the story and the language. Darmok and Jalard both traveled alone to Tanagra, an island, fighting the beast of Tanagra and left together on the ocean. Picard now understands that Daphon hoped that by reliving the same situation that Picard and Daphon could form a bond between their two races. Daphon wants a story time, and so Picard recounts part of the Epic of Gilgamesh. Gilgamesh, a mad king, meeting Enkidu, and they fought together and then became friends at the city of Uruk. They went to fight the great bull of heaven, but Enkidu was killed in the slaying, and Daphon passes during the night. Now risking war, Riker is ready to attack the Temerian ship. Data detects that Daphon has died, and Picard is ready to make a final desperate stand against the creature. Riker attacks the ship, and Picard is beamed back.
Shaka! When the walls fell.
Timber, his arms closed.
Oh no. Best start the stopwatch then.
Temba, his arms open! Picard rushes to the bridge as the Temerian ship attacks and is crippling the Enterprise badly. Picard is finally able to communicate with the Temerians, telling them of Daphon's death, but the success in communicating. Daphon's first officer beams back Daphon's log, uttering Picard and Daphon at Ella Drill. Picard offers the knife, but is allowed to keep it. Maybe not new friends yet, but not new enemies at least. Riker finds Picard reading up on Homeric myths, wanting to know more about his own myths to try and better understand other cultures. He muses on Daphon's commitment to communication being more important in his own life, and as Riker leaves, Picard places his fingers to his forehead as he saw Daphon do at the side of the fire. And probably at that moment, the xenolinguistics expert for the Enterprise beams back on after a really boring vacation where he met a very nice person who he totally failed to get off with and asked O'Brien, hey Miles, anything exciting happened while I was away?
Wow, that's 1:11 over. And yeah, where was their xenolinguistics person? In fact, sorry, there will be many compliments towards this episode, but first of all, one, how does the flagship not have a xenolinguistics expert? Two, how did Troy not pick up on the emotions and go, this is what they're meaning when they say these things?
It's Troy. Her emphatic abilities are only ever as strong as the plot demands.
True, yeah. She's, I assume her CV was, like, packed out with, oh, yeah, the empathy's amazing, and actually it's, you know.
My mom is really special, you guys, although we will hate it when she visits.
Yeah. My mom banged some admirals, probably.
She's able to sense that they have good intentions and are not hostile, but, and you know, it always seems to be that she can sense, like, vague emotional, like, impulses. Yeah.
God, I love that, like, the official report is Starfleet have deemed these people incomprehensible. Oh, no. I've definitely met people like that. So, yeah, that was a fun kind of official diagnosis for any kind of formal communications with them. And, like, I get that it is such a difficult idea to express and to go, yeah, these guys all talk in references, but only they know the references.
Yeah.
Obviously makes no true sense.
I do have the same problem living in the US because I have a very UK specific set of references because I've built a life here. And so once at work, we're waiting for a bad day. It was gonna be a shit show at Starbucks, and I said, "Don't worry, whatever happens, we'll get to it. Thunderbirds are go." Now, if you say the term expression "Thunderbirds are go" to anyone in the UK, they'd be like, "Oh yeah, I get it. Thunderbirds are go. We're ready for anything."
Yeah.
The guy looked at me like I had a hole in the head. I get it.
Yeah, like when you've got a young colleague, that kind of thing, which my current team at work is lovely, but also there is someone there that makes all of us feel incredibly old. And while she's great, at the same time, there have to be a lot of pause, explain the thing, and then keep going of like, should I actually explain the Chuckle Brothers?
Oh,
like,
God.
Is it better for she never know that the Chuckle Brothers existed. R.I.P. one of them, Barry, I think.
I think it's Barry. I would be more happier explaining the existence of the Chuckle Brothers than trying to explain Rolf Harris.
Oh, God, yeah.
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 And I once had a co-worker who were both talking about Batman movies, and we were both referring to that weird old Batman movie. I was talking about Batman 66, shark repellent bat spray, the bomb, the Salvation Army band, and they were talking about that weird old Batman film where Prince does a soundtrack and Jack Nicholson is the Joker, and I have never wanted to defenestrate someone more.
I mean, at some point, someone's going to say that weird old Batman movie and mean, like, Dark Knight Rises.
Oh, God, yeah. That, like, that weird old Batman film. And I'm like, man, I remember when the 89 Batman film was the dark, gritty, realistic take on Batman.
Yeah.
I remember Batmania.
Oh, Batmania. Yes. Yeah, I was given a Batman t-shirt when my school went for an outing at the newly built marina. Ooh. And we watched, I think it was Neverending Story 2. And it was right at the end of term. So it was a kind of end of term thing. And so I was like, who's got a birthday today? And mine was the closest, being the end of July. And yeah, I got a Batman 89 t-shirt that they must have had lingering around there, because this was a couple of years after that. But luckily, I was good with that.
I mean, okay, one thing, outside of any allegorical context of this story, the how the Temerian language works does not make a lick of realistic sense.
Oh, God, no.
No, not at all.
And it's great, but yeah. Like, apparently it took them 2 years to actually get this, like, broken and onto the screen.
Yeah.
And all the while, like, Rick Drummond hated it until it came out and was well-received. And now, of course, he loves it.
Yeah. And it's just like, yeah, I get it. Because how the hell do you tell someone in Temerian, set the microwave for 60 seconds?
Hmm. Yeah.
Kayshon, is food warming? For 1 minute.
Yeah, well, maybe it is just keeping it to the extremely broad, you know. Like, don't overcook this.
Yeah.
You know, King Alfred, when the food was burnt.
Kayshon, who followed the instructions on the packet.
Of course. And, like, this has become the perfect meme vehicle.
Yes.
You know, I was looking up some of these to share, because it is... That it is references. And what do we have as most of our media these days? So much of it is references, whether it's a remake, a reboot, whether it's, you know, trying to call on tropes, you know, fucking Save the Cat that's behind me, old Blake Snyder, ruining things a lot by going, no, these tropes of where it all is. So you see, like, The Rock saving a cat or something, go, that is obviously the good guy, even if he's a bit shady. We know, we can interpret these things, and that might not be the case for another culture or another species. And, you know, we are in Darmok now, whether we like it or not. Because yeah, when, you know, Geordi LaForge looking down and then pointing at the different things. And the Paul Winfield, the guy who plays Dathan, who was also in Star Trek 2, he is so beautifully expressive.
Oh, God.
Like, moment that JL gets it, and he's like, yes!
Yes! Yes!
Yeah! Yeah, mate! I love that kind of, just that pure joy in his face of, you said the thing! You said it. You got it,
you,
mate.
You said it and you meant it. It's just, oh my God. Oh. The makeup is really good by being like very alien, but then it's able to just express everything.
Yes. Yeah. Sometimes you get the makeup where it looks difficult to express, difficult to emote. And like, you end up, I don't know about you, but I ended up watching the makeup on his face when he was making the expressions, and like, the top bit was a bit more static, but the amount that the rest had kind of give, was able to move to kind of fit that, was brilliant. And even his mates up on the ship, who were having a much more confusing time of it, like, knowing, coming into it, this is one that I have vivid memories of seeing as a kid.
Yeah.
Where they're just like, what the fuck are these guys on about? Like, oh my God, look, we got this test. And of course, for them, it's all that they have conflicting conversations and arguments just using their references was confusing, but in a very fun way.
There is a different version of the story which goes like into attempting to be comedic and would just be offensive.
100%, yeah. Like, the original plan apparently was just that there would be a kid who only said Darmok, and that just meant play, and that was what was needed. And it's like, no, this creates some complicated thoroughness to it, you know. Yep. Like, there's a reason this keeps getting used with the introduction of a Temerian character in Lower Decks, because it is interesting. And even though there's a bit more leeway in how that character talks in the show, it's interesting. Like, this is a thing that when you think of Star Trek,
this is
a thing.
Okay, can I quickly talk about Doctor Who?
Yeah, yeah. Oh shit, I've lost the egg timer, but know that you're being judged.
What else is new?
Yeah, fair.
Apparently, Russell T. Davis heard about this episode and the log line and was just like, this sounds amazing, I'm not gonna watch it. Because, like, I'm worried it won't hold up. And this inspired the episode... It's Russell T. Davis. And this inspired the Doctor Who episode Midnight. When the Doctor is stuck on the trailer with this alien force which only communicates by copying you. And then starts saying what you're saying before you've said it. And, like, is just... that episode is one of the most terrifying episodes of Doctor Who.
Oh, it's very good fun.
But yeah, like, apparently that was this episode where, I guess, when RTD finally got around to watching it. But just like the episode and the logline of the concept of a race that can only communicate by metaphor, I guess he was like, that sounds amazing.
Yeah.
And it does. Like, okay, this is Star Trek at its most Rod Serling allegorical science fiction. Where it's like, you're not meant to think of this in any kind of real world, real stakes, real implications. We are telling a story about communicating, and this is how we choose to tell the story.
Yeah, and that's the thing that I feel often gets forgotten. This is fiction.
Yeah.
Like, this is a fictional story about fictional things happening in a fictional universe, and it does not need to be 100% literal.
No.
This language would be bonkers to actually exist, and it doesn't, that's fine.
Yeah,
like, we have this as a method of communicating, again, see memes, but it needs other things. But for this episode, I don't give a shit.
Like, for me, like, everything I love about this episode is just the way Paul Winfield just kind of Winfield just sighs and says Gilgamesh when Picard begins telling him the story of the Epic of Gilgamesh. Like, that's, that entire scene is, I think this is one of those scenes where I actually watched it more than the episode itself, because I just love the scene of Patrick Stewart recounting part of the Epic of Gilgamesh.
Yeah.
The alien who doesn't get it, but gets it.
When he's condensing it down into basic language in order to better express in a way that Dathan might be able to click with, and seeing him kind of adapting, and yeah, that just that moment in the campfire where Dathan is wounded, he's tired, and just like Gilgamesh, it's like, yeah,
it's like, man. The childlike joy of just of learning. And then I love the end of Picard and Dathan at El Aladril, because that just feels like it's not just a metaphor, it is how they communicate their history, and in his own way, Picard has now become part of the language of the Temerian people. Like, he is part of that living history, which, as we see in Lower Decks, leads to the Temerians joining Starfleet, and I love Kayshon in Lower Decks. It helps that in his first appearance he gets turned into a puppet.
Yes, that was great.
and that he does the Naruto ninja run. And he never does much. He's just there to kind of just like be a background character. Like, he seems to hang out with Ransom a lot. And I remember there's like a lovely moment when Ransom like is exasperating and does a Temerian reference, and Keishon's like, "Aw, you pay attention," and they fist bump.
The fact that because Picard and Dathon have become a reference, that is, you know, there you go. There's your groundwork done.
Yeah.
For getting them to join. And that's brilliant. Like, I don't know. I love that is the thing of like, okay, now he has become that kind of that fiction for them that can be used as part of their language. On a much more fickle note, we get Picard's new jacket, which the material for the top bit for the shoulders felt distracting. It felt a little bit kind of someone's leather jacket.
Yeah.
You know, like someone took it off of like some midlife crisis guy's scooter leather jacket kind of thing.
I don't know, like the shoulder, like the very pronounced shoulder pads.
Mm.
You know how in nearly every single Grant Morrison comic, he puts a character in like a leather jacket over like a superhero costume? Like, famously, he does it with Robot, with Zenith. He did it with Animal Man in his run on Animal Man. And he gave Robot Man a jacket in Doom Patrol. It just feels like the quintessential Grant Morrison coat.
What? Give the person a jacket? Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, I guess, like, they didn't do that with Flex Mentolo or Sea Guy, but yeah. I don't know, in a way, it's like in the 90s with superheroes in bomber jackets, where you go, like, Cyclops' outfit, fine. But stick a nice jacket over it. It's like, it means business now.
The yellow jacket's in New X-Men.
Hmm.
I mean, okay, in Animal Man, he does kind of give, like, a half-hearted reason for the jacket. It's just like, I just need something to keep like my keys and loose change just in case I need to use the phone.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, it's a nice touch. Apparently it was very much just to be a way of distinguishing the captain from the rest of the crew. And we've seen that fashion in Starfleet seems to change pretty regularly. You know, I think I'd assume the kind of grey shirt, like undershirt thing, is what leads to the similar grey being the shoulders for like First Contact and such later on. But yeah, once they figure out the jacket, fucking good jacket.
Picard, his jacket nice.
Yes. Yeah. And I guess the others don't get a massive amount to do and feel a little behind. You know, if I'm looking for criticism, they come to figure out, they get the same realizations, just a bit differently.
And I think it helps, you know, sell why Picard and Dathon are able to communicate, learn to communicate, because they're sharing the experience.
Yes.
Whereas, you know, meanwhile, the crew on the ship are engaging in bad level media criticism. They're showing poor media literacy across the board. Meanwhile, Worf is just pissed off and just wants to start a fight.
Yeah, just, you know, okay, these people are too confusing. Should we be hitting them?
Oh god, Worf just feels like the least, the one guy you do not want to talk to in Metaphor.
Yeah, oh god. Yeah, if there is someone wholly unequipped to understand the Temarian language, it is Worf.
I feel like Worf would be like Carrot in the Discworld Night's Watch series of books, where at one point Vimes tells Carrot to throw the book at him, and Carrot, quite literally, who is carrying the Book of the Laws of Ankh-Morpork, quite literally throws the book at him. I feel like if someone told Worf to throw the book at them, he would immediately go to the replicator, get a book, come back, and just kind of half-heartedly... Yeah.
Yes, I know this feels wrong, but it was the instruction. I don't know, that feels almost close to Guardians of the Galaxy Drax.
He would just look confused, that's the point. Like, Morpheus, I will throw the book. Or, wouldn't it be Data? Data would go, there's an old Earth colloquialism that's gone on for far too long, thus killing the joke.
Oh god, definitely. I think the only other thing that I'm a bit ambivalent around was the Power Rangers villain that's the monster with it. But the monster didn't matter.
The monster doesn't matter. Like, the monster is what they have to fight.
Yeah, like, it was fine. But, yeah, they aren't there for that.
It's a beast. This is like a weird inverse of Arena.
Mm.
The TOS episode we've eventually got to get to. Where
one day, and then I'll see it outside of Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey.
What about outside the context of that one episode of Mythbusters when they try and replicate Kirk's like makeshift cannon to see if that would actually work in real life?
I have never seen a single episode of Mythbusters.
It's fun.
Okay.
And spoiler, yeah, it wouldn't work. The gun would explode.
Well, that's fine.
But you know what won't explode?
Oh.
Our big list.
Not yet. Not if we keep feeding it episodes. So, yeah, I'm scrolling the hell up. So, Darmok. And at the moment, I'm looking at, like, number 9, we've got Where the Warrior, which is good fun with the Klingons fighting everyone in Deep Space Nine and on Cardassia. And I feel this is probably better than that.
Yeah, like, you know, Where the Warrior is good space opera. Like, yeah. It's Deep Space Nine kind of just embracing, like, full on, we're going to do a big Babylon 5 war arc for the rest of the show, and introducing Worf, who is better utilized in Deep Space Nine, and he kind of ever does get in TNG.
Mm.
Worf interacting with his new co-stars. I think that this is good science fiction.
It is. It is very good science fiction. Like, it feels like it would work both as classic sci-fi and even as some more modern stuff.
Like, this feels like that you could make this like into an episode of the Twilight Zone and the Outer Limits, and you wouldn't lose like anything in translation.
Yeah, like a really long Future Shock.
Yeah,
one of the early ones where they did go on a bit.
I don't know. I feel that this is too hopeful to be a Future Shock.
True, it needs some ironic twist.
In the same way, it would be too hopeful to be an Outer Limits, because the Outer Limit twists usually tend to be bad ones. While the Twilight Zone usually tends to be, I would say, tends to err on more hopeful and humanist.
And maybe the Future Shock version would be like, oh no, we've learnt just in time. They've said your ship's got a fuel leak, but in reference or like someone stuck something in it. You know, like Beverly Hills Cop, when Judge Reinhold put a banana in the exhaust pipe. Or was it Eddie Murphy? Might have been Eddie Murphy.
I don't know. I've never seen any of the Beverly Hills Cop.
My brother and I really enjoyed them when we were young. I can't remember. Like, I think my dad got us watching some of Eddie Murphy's stand-up. And then, yeah, we're like, okay, this is fairly standard action stuff, but yeah,
with Eddie Murphy.
It was all right.
Speaking of Eddie Murphy, and in a quick reveal of what we're going to be doing next episode, Eddie Murphy was going to be in a little film called Star Trek 4.
Yeah, we've got things to say about that. Speaking of Star Trek 4, the next one up is on our list is number 8, Star Trek 3, The Search for Spock. That is a very good movie.
Yeah.
Is Darmok better than Star Trek 3?
Oh my god.
Yeah.
Darmok is good science fiction, but like Search for Spock has so many fantastic moments.
Yeah.
Like McCoy trying to be Spock. Some good acting from Billy Shatz.
Hey, that won't last.
No. Christopher Lloyd stealing the show.
Yeah.
As the baddie.
Okay, so does this mean we're putting this as the new number 9 above Where the Warrior and below Search for Spock?
I think so.
Because, yeah, like, as you were mentioning it, it's like, yeah, there are some fucking great moments,
like
in Star Trek.
Like, right? I feel like it gets poorly talked about as a follow-up to Wrath of Khan, but in its own right, I think Search of Spock is a very good movie.
See, I don't necessarily subscribe to the even-numbered movies are the only good ones.
No,
because our list shows, because both the motion picture and Star Trek 3 are pretty high up.
Yeah.
You know? I think they're still... Are they both... Yeah, they're both...
They're both top 15. 20. For...
So, yeah.
Well, no, because yeah. Now motion picture's going to... Oh, no, motion picture is going to be... is the new number 15.
Yeah.
Okay. And that was our show.
It was indeed. So, if you like what we do, that's great. Go rate us on your varied podcatchers. Go to the YouTube channel, subscribe to us, and maybe fling a like onto some of the videos. I have been seeing that we have been getting views on there, which has been nice.
Oh, good.
And people catching up with some of the older episodes. As some of them evidently are topics for the peel. So that's good. Next time, however, we are, as Miles has said, looking at Star Trek 4, The Voyage Home, which is very exciting. It's the first Star Trek movie I saw, and I remember it fondly.
Unfortunately, it is not the first Star Trek film I saw. That's going to be number 5.
Oh dear.
Yeah.
And yet you are here doing this.
Yet I'm here doing this. That.
Yeah, there's something that won't be in the top 15. Anyway, until then, if you want to support us financially, that's very welcome at our Ko-fi, which is ko-fi.com/casualtrek. And I still haven't figured out Patreon yet. Give it some time. We'll get there. We also have a Blue Sky account, which is casualtrek.bsky.social. Miles, where can folks find you?
And they can find me on my Blue Sky account at milesreedlibato.bsky.social or on my blog at mareedlibato.wordpress.com.
Yes, I can also be found on Blue Sky at skyshark.bsky.social and on fakedtales.com, where I'm currently doing a retrospective of my experiences reading 2000 AD, which, as it's currently delaying me reading further with 2000 AD, I'm kind of rereading the first few years of it because I like make a rod for my own back. But it's good, so I don't care too much. So yeah, that's it from us. And until next time, go do a Starfleet.
And have a jelly baby.
Yes, Picard and Dathon at El Adrel.
You have been listening to Casual Trek, a Nerd and Tie podcast, presented by Charlie Etheridge Nunn and Miles Reed Lobato. Music by Alfred Etheridge Nunn. Edited by the hosts and by Rihanna Reed Lobato. Star Trek is owned by Paramount. Not us. Not yet.